Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra. As always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good evening to you from a good afternoon here.
Right. Yeah, I had to get my head around that. So where are you now, Andrew? You're in LA, right?
I'm in LA in my hotel room. It's potentially a bit noisy. I can't tell. There seems to be a lot going on around here between stuff outside. And I think a few minutes ago, they appeared to be hoovering the room upstairs with, I'm guessing, some kind of industrial suction device, because I literally couldn't hear myself think, and I was a bit worried about it might come out on the podcast. But yes, I'm in LA.
Congratulations. I am in Broadstairs in Kent.
Okay. What brings you to such an august location?
Just the width of all the staircases, I guess. This place, you know, has its name for a reason. No, I'm on a sort of a classic English seaside break, and the weather forecast is rain for the entire week. So I've timed it beautifully.
Perfectly. Yeah, it's warm here, but not particularly sunny where we are, which is a bit of a shame. But look, it's very much a first world complaint and first world problem. So I won't go on about it. You've been busy, from what I can see. I haven't been on social media that much since I've been here, but I did notice your rather extraordinary performances at the Royal Albert Hall, of all places. I mean, that's basically like getting to play at Wembley, right?
Yeah, I guess so, in sort of classical music terms. Yeah, it was mad. I did so Horrible Histories did a special performance at the BBC Proms, which are like a series of concerts held annually every summer. And it's a huge, extraordinary venue, Royal Albert Hall. It's like 5,000 plus people. Last time I went there, it was to watch Return of the Jedi played with like an orchestra playing the score along. It was very cool.
Wow.
And then somehow they ended up letting me go on that stage and act and sing. So it was very, very, very cool, particularly because we were doing it in conjunction with the English National Opera, ENO, and their orchestra and their choir. And I'm sure you've been inundated with people coming up to you and saying, oh, thanks for doing the podcast while you're in the States. But I didn't necessarily expect to get that at the Royal Albert Hall. But I had a guy come out of the orchestra who's a big fan. He's a bassoon player. I had someone come out of the chorus singers who said, oh, my son loves your show, and will you say hi to him? So, it, you know, it was very cool and a weird colliding of worlds. I'm sure you've experienced an awful lot of that in your time in the States, no doubt.
Yeah. I love the fact that there's a professional bassoon player out there who's a big listener to the Arscast.
It's mad,
Arscast Extra, yeah, it is. And, yeah, there was loads of that in New York. We were here on Friday night. We did went to the event on in Union Square that Arsenal NYC put on. I mean, absolutely packed and amazing to see so many Arsenal fans in the city and meet so many people as well, and just have a chat, a brief chat, because there were just so many people. You're getting pulled from pillar to post in a way, but in a good way, you know, because it's always a pleasure to meet people. And even last night, Tim Stillman got in. I'm here with Elliot as well. Elliot and I traveled down from New York yesterday. We got here, Tim got in. Tim posted a picture. We were having a drink outside. Tim posted a picture. And you know what Arsenal Twitter is like, right? You know, you
sure
could sort of say, like, where is, you know, where is this? And you could post a grainy, pixelated picture of, I don't know, Kylian Mbappe on his way to the Arsenal training ground. You know, Arsenal Twitter can CSI the shit out of anything. They will find it. Two different people came on and said, oh, I saw the picture. And I was like, that's just around the corner for me. And they came down to say hello. So that was
no way.
Cool.
Yeah, I suppose they'd probably cool. already tracked the flight. If they're Arsenal fans on Twitter, they'd tracked you on Elliot's plane from New York to LA. So they were well aware of your whereabouts. That's dedication. I like it.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. And then, of course, we went to the game on Saturday at the MetLife Stadium.
Yeah. How was that experience?
It was a bit weird in that I was in the press box, and I don't know if you've encountered a press box at a big NFL stadium before.
I'd guess behind Perspex or glass, maybe.
Correct. Yeah, it was like that when we were in Charlotte as well in 2019. The press box in the stadium in Charlotte. I can't remember the name of the team that play there, but it is an enormous stadium, and you are basically behind glass, so you can see the crowd and you can hear the very loud roars of the crowd, but you don't get any sense of the atmosphere. You don't get any sense of the interactions on the pitch and stuff like that. So you're essentially watching a game in silence, which is kind of weird. You know the way you say you'd love to watch a game without the commentary, but you'd still want the crowd noise. You wouldn't want to watch it with the sound turned all the way down. So it was a little bit like that. And I don't know if that had an impact on how I viewed the game versus some other people. I don't really know.
I've only had that experience last summer when I went out on the US tour, and it's my first time working in a stadium there. And I have to say, it did make me feel very detached from the events. Maybe if you're sort of there in a purely kind of analytical sense, maybe there is a kind of, maybe there is a benefit to that. But I think the atmosphere is such a part of soccer and football. You know, it seems a shame to be sort of literally removed from it by a barrier. I didn't particularly enjoy it myself.
No, it's not great. I mean, the most noise that was made in the press box is when I'm sure you've seen the video of the fight, have you?
I haven't actually. I haven't, Andrew.
Oh, so probably about halfway through the second half, there were like, I was watching the game and then I heard a big swathe of the press box go, ooh, and there was, oh, and I was like, what's happening here? Because I'm not seeing anything on the pitch that reflects those noises. And they had actually caught sight of these fans swinging punches at each other and all kinds of stuff. And that carried on for about a couple of minutes, I think, that these guys were throwing haymakers and everything else. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. I don't know what they were. I don't know what they were at in a preseason friendly. And it did appear to be maybe Arsenal fans fighting other Arsenal fans, or I don't know exactly what it was.
Certainly people in – I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm watching it now. Lord only knows what happened there, but yeah, not particularly pleasant scenes, and
no,
not and quite strange to see that at a pre-season friendly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I would be keen to get involved in that kind of thing. And the police here are fairly serious, right? So you wouldn't want to be bringing yourself to their attention. There was a guy in blue who basically did what the guy that kicked Aaron Ramsdale. He sort of slunk off into the crowd and then sat down, not realizing all the time that there was a camera on him the whole way. This guy went around down the bottom of an aisle, went up the stairs, and then I think he was intercepted by a couple of stewards who didn't seem that keen on breaking up the fight. I mean, I suppose, these big lumps of guys are throwing themselves around. You don't want to get involved there either. But then he went into the seats, and I think he sort of sat down or tried to lie down to hide. I don't know if he got caught in the end. But, that was what got the press box going more than the actual game itself. And I don't know if that's just the fact that it was unusual, or if it's a consequence of the fact that when you're watching a game from within the confines of that, from behind Perspex, it's hard to really connect with it, you know?
Yeah. What about before the game and around the stadium? Was there a good atmosphere there? And did you get to be part of that at all?
No, not really, because it took ages to get there. We got a taxi, and it took a long time to get there. And we had to sort of go around and try and get to the press entrance to pick up the credentials and things like that. And we'd walked three quarters of the way around the stadium because of where we were dropped off, and we had to sort of walk around. And we got to a certain point, and they said, no, you've got to walk all the way back around the other side, until a very nice lady helped us and allowed us to get through and get there in time. But, you know, there was the tailgate thing, people in the car parks, grilling burgers and sandwiches and kicking footballs around, but really didn't get a chance to experience any of the pregame stuff there. And post-game, it was, again, another bit of a, not a shit show, but it's quite a difficult place to get to and get out of because of all the traffic. It's 85,000 people, and it's sort of out in Jersey somewhere. And there is a train, but that train takes you to another train station where you can get a train back into New York or wherever you're going. But it was a strange sort of experience, but I hope a good experience for the people who actually went to the game and were actually in the stadium and in the stands and soaking up the atmosphere and getting to see the team perhaps for the first time. It wasn't a great game. I don't know how much of it you saw. Did you see much at all?
I watched the Arsenal YouTube channel highlights package, which strangely skipped over this fight. sounds like that may have been certainly one of the more dramatic moments. But it happened kind of during the middle of the night here. And as you say, I was working quite intensively last week on a show. So I thought I can't quite brave staying up all night and then going into rehearsals. But yeah, I watched the highlights and I kind of soaked it up through social media, really. I saw people's reactions and assessments. And I mean, I guess it was a chance to have a look at, you know, another look at some of the new players, but yeah, not as successful as our outing against the MLS All-Stars, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I mean, he did start with a midfield of Rice, Havertz and Odegaard, which I guess is understandable. A chance for him to have a look at it. And he was in the press conference afterwards. He was asked about, I think it was Kaya who asked him about those guys starting together and how effective he thought it was and all the rest of it. He said, look, they'll be much better after 55 games and they know each other and all the rest, which is, I think, true. But you don't really have 55 games, do you? You've got like maybe another two games before it gets serious. So where do you stand on the this is just preseason and we shouldn't pay too much attention to the performance? It's a fitness exercise. You know, there is obviously a benefit to winning a game like this because you can create a little bit of momentum. Whether you can take it into the season or not is another thing. But also, I suppose there is a benefit, if you want to call it that, in things not working because it does highlight perhaps what you need to do on the training ground and all the rest.
Yeah, I think that it's impossible really to talk about it without considering last summer and the fact that Arsenal had quite a strong pre-season and carried that into the competitive campaign. I was looking back actually at some of the teams we picked, the results we got, and it was the third friendly of our US tour where we really clicked. I think we played Everton and DC United potentially or something like that. And they were actually quite ragtag teams at that point in time. The second friendly of the tour, I think the back four was something like Cedric, Holding, Pablo Mari and Nuno Tavares. It was something as you know, makeshift as that. But in the final game, we played Chelsea and we beat them 4-0. And Arteta played what sort of consequently became the team. You know, Zinchenko had arrived by that point from Man City at left back. Ben White played at right back. It was the first 11 that we saw plenty of times last season. Saliba alongside Gabriel, Xhaka in the number 8 role, Jesus up front. They were all there and it all clicked. And from that point on, we were on a roll. We played it again against Sevilla in the Emirates Cup and absolutely smashed them. And that team took all that momentum into the season. So I do think it can be a really positive period, one that can really set you up well, start the ball rolling and, you know, show signs of a team clicking into life. I think what's tricky maybe this time round is I think there is just quite a lot of adjustment to make. I mean, you spoke about the midfield three. That is a significant evolution and one that, all right, listen, maybe it can't take 55 games, but I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest it's going to take some games. The chances of that just working from the off, as Mikel Arteta has envisaged, seem quite slim. There seems to be an inevitable sort of teething process we're going to have to go through. And hopefully we can pick up the results along the way. But it's no surprise to me that there were some signs of a slight lack of cohesion because it's all new.
Yeah, quite a bit of it is new. And I think there were some things that were noticeable in that Martin Odegaard played a bit deeper and Havertz mm-hmm. led the press in the way that Odegaard did it. And I don't know if that's what Mikel Arteta is planning for the season ahead or whether that's just something he wanted to have a look at, you know? And where better to take a look at something than in a preseason friendly against Premier League opposition? I mean, it has to be something that they factored into when they've made their plans for this summer and they've thought about how this team is going to develop and evolve and all that kind of stuff. That if you do basically strip out two-thirds of your midfield and put in two-thirds of it that's new, that there are potentially teething troubles or they're going to take some time to work together. But you've also got to balance that with the knowledge that in the Premier League, when you're up against a team like Manchester City, as we've said, the margin for error, whether it's at the start of the season, midway through the season, or at the end of the season, every single point you drop feels seismic. So how do you think those conversations have gone? Or is it a case that Arteta is confident that with the time he's got left, he's still got the game on Wednesday here against Barcelona, there's a game against Monaco next week, and then there's the Community Shield before the real business kicks in. Do you think he's confident that he can, if this is what his actual plan is, that he can make that work?
Yeah, I think he's got a little bit more wiggle room this summer. I think we might have a friendly or two more, which, you know, again, gives him slightly more time to get things together. And as I say, it wasn't really until the end of the tour where Arsenal really clicks into gear, and there's still time for that to happen. Hopefully that Barcelona game isn't in any doubt. Has there been any update on the illness that had plagued Barcelona? Arsenal seem confident they'll be fine to play that one, right?
Yeah, that is the line anyway, that the two clubs have been in contact and they are confident that this game will go ahead. Right. And it'll be another really big test, won't it? It'll be a big test for not just the midfield. You know, when you think about the players that Barcelona have and who they could put out in midfield, it will be really challenging for whichever trio he picks, if it's Rice, Havertz, Odegaard again, which I think it probably should be, if that's, you know, a big part of his thinking. The more they play together, the more easily these things will come together, and they can make the adjustments that will make it work, you know, because Rice is different from Partey. Havertz is different from Xhaka. Odegaard, we know what he can do. So it's about, I suppose, finding the blend, and perhaps that's why he was trying to do it a little bit differently with Havertz pressing the other day.
Yeah, I think it is going to take a bit of time. I mean, I said this on YouTube the other day, but if all Mikel Arteta and Arsenal were thinking about was how do we hit the ground running and compete with Man City in this season to come, I think you'd probably insist on keeping Granit Xhaka, and you probably start the season playing the same midfield that you ended last season with and slowly bed new players in. But I think Arteta, and particularly Edu in his role, they have to think bigger than that. They have to think, yes, this is about being hugely competitive next season and pushing City even harder. But it's also about how do we sustain that over 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Mm. And some of the changes we're seeing are about getting younger and replacing players who are in their late 20s, early 30s. So I think there's a kind of, there's a long-term motivation for these changes, but there's also a short-term pressure to deliver results. And balancing those two things is the challenge for every football manager, for every football club. I think he must have faith, but it's quite nice. You know, Thomas Partey is still in the squad. From the comments Mikel Arteta made the other day, it sounds like he's going to be in the squad for the foreseeable future. I guess that does offer him a degree of comfort, right? It's if a party stays, it means he can revert to some things that have worked in the past, and doesn't have to completely reinvent the wheel, as it were, you know, from the very get-go. If he starts the season and this isn't showing signs of clicking immediately, he can kind of put the brakes on a bit on the evolution and say, look, we'll stick Partey in there and maybe put Rice in the Xhaka role. And, you know, that might be a more, how can I put it, a more steady evolution rather than a dramatic revolution of the midfield.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And I think, you know, on a purely footballing basis, there's no question that an Arsenal squad with Thomas Partey in it is a strong one, or is a stronger one than one without him, regardless, I think, of who you get in as a replacement. Because when you've spent the amount of money that we've spent, I don't think you're necessarily going to be going out and buying another finished article player. I think you're going to have to perhaps adjust and bring in somebody who might develop into that role. So, yeah, it does give him a bit of a safety net in that regard. Elliot was saying he wouldn't be surprised if Partey started the season. I don't quite know whether that would be at the expense of Declan Rice. I can't imagine that, because, you know, the £100 million player is gonna need to play. But where exactly he might play if Partey gets in the team will be quite interesting.
It strikes me that Havertz maybe has the biggest adaptation to undergo in terms of what he's going to be asked to do next season as opposed to what he was asked to do last season. And that might be the one that takes a little more time. I found it fascinating. Martin Odegaard gave an interview right at the start of the tour. I think it maybe was like a round table thing with a number of journalists. And he spoke about the new signings coming in. And one of the things he mentioned was, you know, that it can take a little bit of time to understand the game model at Arsenal, because Arteta's degree of instruction, his tactical plan is so specific, that the players literally take time to sort of learn the ropes, to learn the way it works, the patterns of play. And I think the speed in which they can kind of acclimatise to that is going to be critical. I mean, I always pick Leo Trossard out as someone who seemed to almost intuitively understand what it was Mikel Arteta wanted from him. But for some players, let's say Gabriel Martinelli, it takes more time. Granted, he was very young, but it is interesting the speed at which the intelligence the players are going to have to show in order to get to grips with what it is Arteta specifically wants from them. That's the challenge for these new boys.
I think that's true. And I think the other thing on that is the fact that the guys who were there last season understand, and now they're learning variation, perhaps. They're learning some slightly different tactical things. And Arteta spoke, didn't he, about having different ways of playing against the opposition. He doesn't want to be predictable. He said, we have to be unpredictable. Whereas these guys are having to come in and learn, you know, plan A, plan B, plan C, you know, in very basic terms, that's not it. But you know what I mean? They're having to learn all of it, whereas the other guys are sort of making incremental steps in terms of what they've got to learn. So it becomes easier for them.
Yeah, you're right. They've got a head start, and some of these other guys are playing catch up. So whether they can catch up in time for Nottingham Forest on their opening day, we'll see. I mean, I wanted to ask, Jurrien Timber played at right back, I think I'm right in saying. Believe it or not, the right back didn't make a great deal of impression on the 4-minute highlight package I watched. But how did he get on?
He was interesting. I don't think anybody was particularly good on the day, but he certainly popped up in areas, as he did in the MLS All-Star game, where you didn't necessarily expect a right back to be. What was interesting was Takehiro Tomiyasu starting at left back.
Yeah.
And maybe not inverting quite as much as you would expect from him, because he's played that position before. And there was maybe a little more balance on the other side, where Timber came inside and Tomiyasu stayed. And then Tierney came on at half time, of course, and played as a very traditional left back. He didn't really come into midfield at all. I think we brought maybe Timber started the second half. I think he did anyway. I think there was only one change at halftime. And I can't remember what that was. I think it was Tierney for Tomiyasu, in fact. That was the only change at halftime. And he made more changes then as the game went on. But it's sort of hard again for me to make an assessment of him beyond like playing in a team that didn't really click on the day, on a pitch that wasn't brilliant, where in fairness to Arsenal, we did have a couple of chances early on. I think Martinelli had a double chance, which was saved. And then both of United's goals, I'm absolutely sure the Arsenal players involved will feel like they should have done better. You know, Ramsdale on the save and Gabriel with a miss kick, which let Sancho go through.
Individual errors, you know, on those ones.
Yeah. I mean, who did stand out for me a little bit when he came on was Emile Smith Rowe. He came on and played as a sort of left eight, which was interesting. And
yeah, we had somebody who got in touch actually about that. I'll just, seeing as you've mentioned it. Who was it? Yes, Alexander Muster on Twitter said, "Hey guys, should we be encouraged by Emile Smith Rowe's performance against United? He looked very determined, fit, and wanted to make things happen." Was that your takeaway as well?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it wasn't a great day for anybody really, but he did look sharp. He looked fit. You know what he looked like? He looked like a guy who spent most of the summer playing competitive football, whereas the rest of them obviously haven't been. And I think that little bit of edge showed. But, I was pleased to see it. I was pleased to see him not just sort of come on in a game like this and jog around. I think he knows he has something to prove. And I think he wants to do that. Maybe I'm reading too much into a 15, 20 minute cameo or whatever it might be, but you know, you could easily have looked at that and said, yeah, he's just kind of going through the motions here. But he wasn't. He was sharp and he was alert and played some good passes. And it was probably the most encouraging thing about that game for me. That and William Saliba, who was just, I don't know what to say about that guy. He's just unbelievable. Bit of a Rolls Royce of a player. Makes everything just look so simple and so easy. But there wasn't a great deal to take away from the game in positive terms from Arsenal. United played quite long, and I think that was deliberate because we have had some issues with teams who play long. I think we did towards the end of last season a little bit as well, and I think that was part of their plan. And, you know, we got exposed. Again, individual mistakes. I don't think even the Ramsdale one was a mistake per se. The ball just really dipped down in front of him from the Fernandez shot. Like, I think he should have done better and probably saved it, but it wasn't like a huge error, whereas the Gabriel one absolutely was. And then there was a penalty shootout at the end.
I didn't really understand that. Is that a function of whatever competition this friendly is supposedly taking place in?
It could be. I'm sure there is a rule book somewhere. It felt to me very much like, well, we've got them here. Let's give them a little extra entertainment. Perhaps, you know, in the effort to avoid people paying big money, you know, for a game of football in the States, and it turns out to be a nil-nil. At least you get some goals in the end. I suspect that's probably what it is. It was just like entertainment at the end. Some good penalties from Arsenal, but there was one bad one from Fabio Vieira, which went over the bar. I think it's meaningless really when it comes right down to it. But it also feels like one that he could have done with scoring at the same time. You know, it was a meaningless penalty kick in a preseason friendly. He blasted it over the bar and you could see the Arsenal players on halfway. They were trying to sort of encourage him and give him a clap, but he looked quite downtrodden about it. And I do wonder if, you know, for his own confidence, it would have been good if that had gone in.
Yeah. I mean, we can say it's a preseason friendly as much as we like, but as you pointed out, there's 80,000 people in that stadium. There's many thousands more watching around the world. And a lot of eyes are on Fabio Vieira because he came here with a big price tag and a strong reputation. And as yet, he's underwhelmed slightly. So I think it could have been a real boost to him to put that away and, you know, be part of a successful shootout. Instead, it's gone the other way. you know, he's a player who needs moments like that to kind of ignite his Arsenal career. Mm. And this is an important preseason period for him because it's something he didn't have last season. So any part he plays could be beneficial. But yeah, it's a shame. He's one of the players who you feel like he could have really done with that going in for his confidence, you know?
Yeah, and for people's faith in him or otherwise. Like
perception, you know, yeah.
Yeah, the perception of him among the fan base, I think, is a little tarnished for understandable reasons. It's a question now of whether Mikel Arteta can get more out of him next season and where exactly he might play as and when he is deployed or picked to play. But like I said, he just looked a bit like, oh, God, I didn't need that today. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm trying to think, was there anything else interesting? Tierney did a bit of a, like immediately after the game, when the players were sort of clapping the fans and Arteta had come on the pitch, he was taken to one side by one of the fitness coaches and he had to do a sort of half sprint down to the bottom of the pitch for some reason that I can't quite figure out. I guess they were maybe testing something, seeing how he felt after his 45 minutes. Flo Balogun didn't get on the pitch in New York. Well, New Jersey, but he, of course, was born in New York. And I'm curious to see whether or not he gets a bit of time on Wednesday night against Barcelona, because Eddie played on Saturday against United. And look, nobody was good. Nobody was particularly good, but he had a poor game, I think. And there's a question in my mind now in that I think for the most part, we know what we're going to get from Eddie Nketiah, what kind of performance we're going to get when he's having a good day and what kind of performance we're going to get when he's not at that level. But we're not 100% sure yet about what Balogun can do in an Arsenal shirt in this team in that position. So on the basis of his performance against United, the door would be open to the other B striker, plan B striker, if you know what I mean. And I'm really curious to see if Balogun does get minutes against Barcelona.
Yeah, I'm curious to see as well. I think from what I heard today, it sounds like what am I going to say here? What time do you think this podcast will go out, Andrew?
It's going to go out almost as soon as we're finished. Right? Yeah, after 10:30. Yeah.
Okay, in which case, so there's a 10:30 p.m. news line coming out. So there's some reports this evening that Balogun didn't train with the main group today, that he was doing individual work with one of the Arsenal coaches. Right now, his chances of featuring against Barcelona, I guess, aren't the best. I don't know why he was doing that individual work. I don't know if he's got an injury problem. You know, Zinchenko was doing individual work too, by all accounts, and that was a fitness thing. So it could be that he's carrying a fitness problem that might preclude his involvement.
Mm.
It could also be that Arsenal are in dialogue with Inter Milan or somebody else about a deal, because you know the window is ticking on and Arsenal have got to get a few out the door, and he's one where I think there is at least a market for him.
I mean, there is probably a bigger discussion to be had, isn't there, about the centre forward position?
If he
does go, and if you continue to get what you're getting from Eddie. I know that there's Jesus. I know that there's Trossard. I know that Havertz can play there, but I don't think that's the plan really for him to play there. You could position him further forward in certain games, but I do wonder if when they're thinking about how they can really upgrade this squad next or how they can add to this squad in a significant way, if striker isn't quite close to the top of the list.
Yeah, I agree with you, actually. It would be for me. I don't get the sense that Arsenal see it as much of a pressing need. But I do think there will be a signing in that position in the next
12 months?
12 months, maybe. I just don't know how many dominoes have to fall for that to be the case. You know, my gut tells me that it would probably require Eddie and Balogun to go this summer for them to do it. But if I was in charge, if I was sat at Edu's desk, it's definitely something I'd be looking at.
So with the game on Wednesday, just looking ahead very quickly to that before we take a break, is there anything in particular you're looking forward to seeing or looking to see from Arsenal beyond, let's say, just a better, more cohesive performance?
Yeah, that would be nice for a start. I mean, I think for me, it is all about that midfield. I'm just fascinated to see. I've sort of earmarked this Barcelona game as the game where I think I want to sort of see what sort of shape we're in, because we'll have played Nuremberg, we'll have played the All-Stars, we'll have played United. Most of the players are now with the squad, not too many injury concerns. For me, this is a bit of a litmus test. And even though it's a friendly, I don't really care about the score, but I do want to see some signs of comfort, you know, on the pitch, of understanding, integration. And even if it means kind of taking one step back to go forward by, you know, bringing Partey back into the 11, or, you know, just reverting to some of the stuff that has worked for Mikel Arteta previously, I think this is about the time that he needs to do that. So, yeah, all eyes on the midfield, really, because I think as much as we all accept that it was the right time to part with Granit Xhaka, and I think as much as we all, you know, recognise his limitations in that position, whoever Arsenal brought in would require some adjustment and maybe a bit of kind of growing pains. And we might have seen a little bit of that against United. So it'd be fascinating to see, yeah, quite how quickly we can progress from there. Is there anything other than that that you're looking for?
No, I'd like to see that midfield trio again, just to give them a bit more time.
If Balogun is involved, that would be really interesting, I think.
It would. I mean, I don't see him starting. Gabriel Jesus didn't start against Manchester United. He came on second half and you know, did all right. But I think they'd obviously looked at the Barcelona game as the one where he's going to start. If Balogun does get on, if he gets a run out in the second half against Barcelona, that would be interesting too. It sort of feels like if he doesn't, like, okay, could just be an injury, right? Could be just a small aggravating injury which is keeping him out.
Yeah.
But this is where his chance was, in a way, to show that he could contribute. So I will keep an eye on that and see what happens, and obviously what Mikel Arteta does with his fullbacks. He didn't start Kivior. Don't think Kivior even came on against United. So whether he goes back to Kivior, I think the decision to start Tomiyasu on Saturday was about getting minutes into his legs after the injury. So they played him for 45 minutes and took him off. So maybe they might play him again. Mm-hmm. And the Ben White Timber battle on the right hand side commences, which is a really kind of fun and exciting one as well, because of the way that they both play. Like, it was noticeable that White stayed wider and higher up the pitch than Timber did when he came on. Is he, you know, obviously plays as an overlapping fullback much more than we've seen from Timber in the last couple of days or the first couple of games that we saw him in. So, yeah, I'll keep an eye on that, and fingers crossed we get a better performance, and the result, you know, isn't a be all and end all, but a much better performance would be encouraging ahead of the last couple of games of preseason.
You in the press box again?
No, not this time. Not this time.
There you go.
So hopefully soak up a bit more of the atmosphere and get more of a flavor of the game in the SoFi Stadium, of course, owned by Stan. So I presume Stan and Josh, etc., will be there.
You'd imagine see the team. So.
Yeah, you'd imagine so. So, yeah, got to put on a show in front of the big boss, you know?
Exactly, yeah. Cal will be taking this one very seriously.
Yeah, all right. Well, look, we'll take a little break here. We're going to come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnerblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. It's not called Twitter anymore, is it?
No, it's called X or something, right?
Stupid. It's the stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard. X.
It's called X because it was formerly a good website. it no longer is.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous. Imagine like having a brand where, you know, the actual name of a brand is basically a verb that people use and identify with in a very serious way. And then you like just change it to x.com because you paid $1 million for the domain name a few years ago and you need to use
it. Well, I think the particular individual involved has got kind of a history of acquiring other people's IP and sort of rebranding it so it looks like his own. It's a pretty transparent thing to do, but there you go.
There you go. Anyway, we will continue to refer to it as Twitter, I guess, because, you know, send us your exes. Sounds really fucking stupid, and I refuse point blank to say it. Let me ask you a question from the Discord. And we had a couple of questions about this. Zach Tay said, do you think the way Manchester United approach the friendly will make Arsenal think twice about playing rivals in preseason friendlies for the future? United were quite physical. There were a couple of bad challenges. I think one from Lisandro Martinez nearly sparked a bit of a scrap, a foul on Saka. So there's that. And then there was another one from Kari, who said, it feels like most managers would rather preseason was as low key as possible in order to get the team ready without hiccups. But do you think having high intensity games like the one against United can help the team get up to speed quicker, or do they do more harm than good?
Yeah, we've come a long way since, you know, Arsene Wenger taking everyone seemingly on sort of an Alpine monastery retreat every summer. I think, you know, the motivation, well, one of the major motivations is obviously commercial, right? That's a big reason that these games are happening. We all remember the proposals of the 39th game. There was a lot of opposition to that, but now we get fixtures which are effectively Premier League matches, just sort of transplanted to the other side of the Atlantic. It's a reality. It's a commercial reality. And I think that Mikel Arteta probably prefers it to playing a kind of minnow from the German fourth division. I think that he probably relishes that it's going to be competitive and a proper tune-up. And it is worth saying that Arsenal, alongside these games that we watch and that are broadcast around the world, they do play some lower key friendlies. You know, they play games behind closed doors at London Colney or sometimes at the Emirates Stadium, be it against Brentford's B team or, you know, whoever else that they drag down from the English lower divisions to play against them. And those are, I think, a bit more relaxed in terms of like the number of substitutions made and the attitude. So there is still a kind of two-pronged approach to pre-season, but I think Arteta is so demanding of his players that he probably would rather see them up against a Barcelona or United than a Biggleswade or whoever it might be. I don't know how much merit he would find in battering someone 6-7-0 that's way below the standard of competition you're going to face in literally a fortnight or so's time.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand that. I think that's right. I just wonder if maybe if you are tweaking things, does it allow you to not play the game as a training exercise per se, but sort of, you know, to use it as precision for the way that you want to play those routines and drills that you've done on the training ground? Can you execute them more easily against a team that is of a lower standard? But maybe you learn more from defeat. Maybe you learn more from a side that knows you well as you know them, and perhaps tries to exploit some of your weaknesses, as I think United did. They got a little bit fortunate the other day. So I think it is probably more beneficial, as you say, than playing Dicklington Rovers. But I think there's also a fear within the hearts of supporters that a cynical fear that, like, okay, here's a game in preseason. Can we kick one of their best players out of the game for a few weeks? I'm not necessarily sure that's the way that footballers think, or other football clubs or football managers necessarily think, not all of them anyway. But I think as fans, we worry about, you know, Lisandro Martinez fouling Bukayo Saka and Saka gets an injury for a few weeks. We are absolutely apoplectic with rage because we are convinced that he did that deliberately, to hamper Arsenal or whatever it is. But if it was just a guy from, you know, a team that doesn't play in the same league, you probably don't jump to that conclusion.
Well, if we did play a team from a lower league and one of them went in two-footed on one of our players, we'd probably be saying, oh, this is what happens, you know, when you come up against players of a lower technical level. Obviously, they're going to rough you up. I think anyone who touches Bukayo Saka, we're basically furious with them, and rightfully so. But I have to be honest and say, as a fan, I don't like us playing against Premier League teams in pre-season. I see that all year round. I'm much more excited about the prospect of a friendly against Barcelona than I am of one against Manchester United, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Me too. I really don't like playing other English clubs in pre-season. But like you say, it is a commercial reality. And there is probably sufficient, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't remember the word, but there's probably enough for Mikel Arteta to take from it as a way to gauge his own team at this point of their preseason preparations, you know, based on what he knows about us as a team, what he knows about Manchester United as a team. You know, that probably gives him reasonably handy markers for what he feels he needs to do.
Yeah, I mean, it does put a pretty interesting complexion on it when you consider that we actually play United in the Premier League in about 5 weeks' time.
Right.
Now, I can't help but wonder, a manager who thinks as much as Mikel does about the game, you know, would it be anywhere in his mind to sort of not reveal his whole hand a month before you play a team in the Premier League? I don't know, but it becomes a consideration, doesn't it, when you're up against a side who you're going to face in just over a month.
Yeah, perhaps there was an element of that to it.
I'm not saying he sent them out to lose to Lull United.
No. I know that.
I don't know. I mean, do you look at it as a training exercise? Do you say, well, let's try this against United. If it works again, if it works, we'll use it again down the road. Do you say, well, let's not play, you know, this player because I'm planning to use them in the Premier League and I don't want United to be studying this video and analysing us to death over the next however many weeks? There's a lot to consider in Arteta's position there.
I think so. All right, your question.
Okay. This is another game, another sort of point on the atmosphere in general. It's from Detroit Flash on the Discord. And they say, I had the pleasure, in inverted commas, of being at the game Saturday. I'm not panicked at all. It's an exhibition. My biggest issue is with the venue. The stadium blared music throughout the pre-game, which meant any singing and chanting were drowned out. The stadium announcer clearly was looking at both team names for the first time, leading to some hilarious pronunciations, and they called a yellow a caution card. Should the teams bring their own operations staff along to these tours to give the fans an authentic experience? My eight-year-old son was disappointed it wasn't like he hears on TV at the Emirates.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't hear any of those hilarious mispronunciations, so I can't really comment on that. I hope he called Harry Maguire Harry Magoo. That would be good. I think you are at the behest of where you're holding the game, because we happen to be talking to a guy in the press box who worked there, and it's his job to do a very specific thing in there when there are NFL games on. But he was then doing the same job for a game of soccer. So I just wonder if contractually you are obliged to use the staff that are in situ. I just don't know if you can reproduce the authenticity of an actual home game, a Premier League game, a game at the Emirates Stadium, anywhere other than there. And I'm not sure you necessarily should either. I do get where what was the name again?
Detroit Flash.
Where Flash is coming from in that sense. But I just don't know if it is replicable because of the context, because of just the way that sport is slightly different in different countries, or the way that it is perceived in different countries is always going to be different. You're always going to have that variation. So I don't know if they're going to bring over like the Arsenal Stadium announcer next time they're in the States, or if they're in the Far East, or if they're in Australia or wherever it might be. I just don't see that as something that's going to happen.
There's only so many seats on that plane, ultimately.
And
I think where I sort of agree with you, and I sort of feel bad saying this for our listeners and the fans stateside, is that I'm not sure you can replicate the authentic Emirates Stadium, North London experience. And I sort of think that's probably quite important that you can't, and it's what makes the home games special.
It's the element of, as much as you want to talk about the importance of preseason, how you don't want to lose to Manchester United, all the rest of it, it is, at the end of the day, though, a result that doesn't go down in the history books in any way. This is not a competitive fixture. It can be a competitive game, but I think when you're actually within a competition itself, there's an element of jeopardy to what's happening on the pitch. You know, because we can sit here and we can say, well, we lost, we didn't play well, we made some mistakes, this is what we go and fix. This is how we improve on that. I was talking to a United journalist afterwards very briefly, and he was pretty confident about their chances for the new season, about how they've been playing so far in preseason and all the rest of it. But at the end of the day, this isn't competition. This isn't there were no points to be gained for anything meaningful in this. So I think that does run through the very heart of a fixture like this, you know, and it's a brilliant thing for fans of English teams when they come to the US, because for many of the people who go to these games, it's going to be the only chance they get to see the team live and in person, because, you know, it's hard enough for people who live in London to get tickets to go and see Arsenal right now.
True.
So, you know, when you add in all the travel and the costs and all the rest of it, it's not easy for fans. So there is an importance to these fixtures in that sense, but they just lack the competitive edge, the proper element of competition that you need to have that authentic experience. So, so there you go.
Yeah, okay, you can kind of do it cosmetically, but you can't fake the stakes ultimately.
Yeah, that's it. Silent Fox 1 says, goodly morning, gents. Why do you think our fan base is so quick to jump on the back of Havertz? It's a brand new position in a complex system, I'm quite disappointed our fan base would think it would be an instant success.
I mean, I have to be honest and say that I've not hugely engaged with the kind of reaction online to the game because, as I say, there aren't real stakes attached to it. But I did see this tweet on Havertz from Steve, at Stevie Steve Steer on Twitter. He said, do you think Havertz may become victim to the body language police a la Ozil? And from the bits and pieces I have seen of him, rather, I find that plausible because he does sort of have that slightly languid gait, which, you know, I think when it's not working for him, he can cut quite a frustrating figure on the field. So he's got that to consider. I think as well, the baggage of Chelsea, which is significant and a burden that he has to bear. And the greatest burden of all, which is that he's replacing a player who was really, really good and really effective for us last season and who isn't there anymore. So I think he's, you know, someone asked us last week which of the new signings is under the most pressure. And I think it is Kai Havertz. Even though we spent £100 million on one of the other guys, I just think there's going to be a lot of focus on Havertz. And in some ways, that's why I say maybe he doesn't start the season. Maybe you do play Partey deep and play Rice as the kind of left eight, a little bit more withdrawn, a bit more like the job Xhaka did last season, just to give him that time. Because, you know, he's coming from a club where he had a really difficult period. And if we've invested in him at the scale that we have, it's because we believe he's going to contribute to us in the long term. So I think they've got to manage this one, you know, quite intelligently.
All right.
To make sure his adaptation is as smooth as possible.
All right. Well, let me just follow on from that with a question from Healthy Salibak on the Discord. And when it comes to sort of managing new signings, new players, expectations, he says, Rice is our biggest signing in quite some time. We expect the world of him. Mikel often talks about protecting the players from overwhelming media attention and focus. Are Arsenal doing enough to let Rice slide in without crushing pressure? It seems like every single piece of Arsenal media content is focused on Rice doing something. Should we not back off a bit?
If Arsenal don't do it, you'll still have the rest of the media doing it. I mean, that is the biggest Premier League deal of the summer. You know, who knows what else will go on and if it will be superseded. But there's going to be a lot of focus on any player you spend £100 million on. And Arsenal will be, I suppose, led by the fans, really. If the fans want to see Declan Rice on Instagram, they're going to get Declan Rice. And I don't really blame them in that respect for doing that. I did want to ask you a bit about him because it struck me in part one, we spoke at some length about Havertz and Timber, but how did Declan Rice fare? And, you know, what was he doing the job that we expected, at the base of the midfield? And was he quite, I heard from a few people that they were sort of surprised quite how withdrawn, quite how deep he was.
Yeah, I think he was playing very much within himself. And I don't know if that's a question of, you know, managing his own physicality and his fitness and his readiness. He seemed to play in quite a conservative way. I mean, he did look for the ball in areas and didn't get it quite a few times. I noticed that in the first half in particular. There were moments where he was coming to collect the ball and it didn't get to him. But, yeah, it was a fairly safe performance, I think you would say, from Declan Rice. He didn't progress the ball a huge amount. He certainly didn't carry the ball in any significant way. And that might have been the way that Manchester United set up. But I think also it was just a player starting his first game for a new club. As we've said, in a system that has taken some of the players a bit of time to get used to.
Well, yeah.
Thomas Partey is a great example, right?
Exactly. We had a question which said exactly that. I'm just going to dig it out now. Big Gabby's Teeth. The usernames are great on Twitter. Said, Are we underestimating how quickly we should expect Declan Rice to adapt to what Arteta wants from his number six? It took Thomas Partey nearly a whole season. So we should definitely keep him next year to allow Rice to settle and ensure we have Partey fit for our biggest games. It is a big adaptation. And again, it's not the exact role he was playing last year at West Ham. He was getting a lot further forward with West Ham, playing in a true kind of box-to-box fashion. He had another guy, Thomas Suchek, in there next to him most of the time. And it's very specific what Rice will need to do at Arsenal. So, yeah, I think it is inevitable there'll be adaptation. I think it was probably unrealistic. You know, this isn't FIFA. It's not a case of just sort of buying players and, you know, suddenly they all click together on the pitch. I think it may take a bit of time. But the reason we've made these changes, because we think in the long term, hopefully in the not too long term, the medium term, it will make us substantially better. But he's got a lot to get to grips with, Rice. I mean,
well, I think that's true. I don't want to be dismissive in any way of David Moyes, but I would say that Mikel Arteta is perhaps a little more demanding as a coach in terms of what he expects from players tactically, right?
Yeah.
So I do think that is something he's going to have to come to terms with. And well, I
also
think he can.
Rice was West Ham was Rice's team. Like, the team was effectively completely built around him and in such a way that it granted him a certain degree of freedom. I'm not sure anyone in Mikel Arteta's team gets quite that degree of license. I think even though there appears sort of freedom in movement and interchanging of positions, I think if you broke it down, you know, it's sort of, I imagine that if you strip it all away, it's like the Matrix, right? It's all numbers, it's all drills, it's all things that Arteta has sort of imprinted upon these players. And Declan Rice is going to be no exception to that. In fact, in his position at the base of the midfield, I think he's going to be probably loaded with as much as tactical instruction as any other player on the field, possibly more.
I agree. And just going back to the original question about the spotlight, I think when a transfer has been, you know, in the offing for as long as that one was, and when it happens, when you spend £100 million on a player, there is an element of media profile, both in-house and externally, that is just going to happen naturally. And like you said, the fans wanted Declan Rice content. That's what they wanted. That's what they got. And I also think in some ways it's potentially helpful in terms of him settling into the club and feeling part of things and feeling included. And I know, like, doing a YouTube video with Saka and Frimi or whatever it might be, you know, that's not going to be the thing that gets his feet completely under the table at Arsenal. But it is just part of how you settle into a new squad, a new group of players. You feel comfortable. You feel like you can, you're really part of the squad and part of the team. I'm sure the £100 million transfer, does that too. But, he doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who is going to be like, oh, you know, I'm a bit in the spotlight here. I'm freaked out now and I'm going to go into my shell. I don't really get that from Declan Rice.
No, he's no shrinking violet. I mean, this is a man who performed Ice Ice Baby, on national television. So
he did what? Yeah.
Say that again.
Did he?
Yes. If you
when?
Dig out, it's on A League of Their Own, the sort
oh,
of
God, yeah.
one sports comedy vehicle. He did perform on that. Rice, Rice, Baby was obviously the lyric. But I think I'd actually go one further and say, I think Arsenal kind of are right to make noise about this transfer. I think it's a really significant transfer in the history of the club and one that's quite important to sort of reposition Arsenal and restate our degree of ambition, our capacity to attract players, our capacity to spend money. And I think it's normal and correct that you kind of leverage that to build the club identity. And it would be very odd if we spent £100 million on a player and sort of got embarrassed about it, you know?
Yeah. That's true. I think it's your question, is it?
Very possibly. Well, I mean, let's make Declan Rice and everyone else feel much better about his transfer fee by talking about another deal. 5-1 at San Siro said, "Afternoon, chaps. What do you think of the £259 million bid for Mbappe from Saudi Arabia?" And then as a follow-up question, he says, "Assuming he goes, would your feeling towards the European Super League change at all, given the massive amounts of money being involved in that competition could bring in, and that it could offer protection for our top players like Saka, Martinelli, Saliba, etc.?"
I don't really understand that part of the question. Like, I don't know what.
I guess what he's suggesting is that does the threat of the amount of money being spent on the Saudi Arabian League make you reconsider your attitude to the European Super League because it might offer some modicum of financial protection
from the Saudi Arabian League?
Yes. Yeah.
No. No. I'm finding it difficult to draw a line between those two things, to be honest. As for the story, I mean, I've only seen it briefly on Twitter, and maybe you know a bit more about it than I do. You know, there's been a bit of, I believe, some shenanigans between PSG and Mbappe. Like, I can't remember exactly what's been said.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he said that he's not going to sign a new contract. His contract expires in a year. And so the Saudi League have come up with this extraordinary offer where they'll pay this extortionate fee and sign him to a one-year contract that would enable him to still join Real Madrid as planned next summer. It's crazy.
I mean, kind of. It's completely insane. It is completely insane. 259 million.
Right. I'm saying it sounds so ludicrous that I'm like, have I even got that right?
I think that's what I read. Yeah, I read the same thing, and it's just, I'm not surprised, but it's also just absurd that this is out there, and this, I don't know if it's going to happen. I don't think Kylian Mbappe is going to go to Saudi Arabia for a year. Do you?
Well, they're offering to pay him something absolutely absurd, aren't they? Like hundreds and hundreds of millions for 1 year.
But what age is he? He's 24. Is he? Kylian Mbappe is 24.
I don't even know if he's as old as that, Kylian Mbappe. He is 24, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I know money talks, and that's an outrageous amount of money.
Fabrizio Romano has reported, yeah, they would pay him 200 million euros for one season.
200 million
and
euros.
They believe that his income could get closer to 700 million euros a year with commercial arrangements and image rights.
I mean, that as well is 200 million basically tax free, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's getting close to a billion in.
I mean, I presume PSG have said yes to this.
Believe it or not, PSG have shown that they may be open to this deal.
Right, that is a surprise, yeah.
Because the belief is that Mbappe has an agreement with Real, you know, to go there in 12 months' time.
Yeah.
And for PSG, this presents an opportunity to recoup some money on a player who they otherwise could well lose for nothing.
I mean, I have zero sympathy for PSG, obviously. You know, if this is not something they could have seen coming and didn't deal with, you know, that's their tough shit. This is a great solution for PSG, if you want to call it a solution. This would be amazing for them. So I genuinely hope it doesn't happen. And I also think, like, there's enough money in the Mbappe bank account already, I think, for him to, I mean, it's such, I can see what the Saudi Arabian League is trying to do. And as I've said before, when the Premier League has been the biggest and richest football league in the world, when somebody else tries to match that or buy not credibility, but buy players who can increase the level, you know, why shouldn't they? But it is and would be at this point a huge backward step in his playing career. To play in that league. And I just can't believe that a serious guy at this stage of his career would contemplate that. But I suppose maybe the other thing is, what is the threat from PSG if he doesn't sign? Are they going to play him? I mean, they couldn't just not play him, right?
Well, he's their best player. I mean, another interesting sort of wrinkle in it all is that, you know, there's a European Championships in 2024. Would Mbappe warm up for that by playing in Saudi for a year? I really don't know. Maybe I'm being naive. You tell me, am I being naive? I still feel, for all the money that's sloshing around, that the players that are choosing to go to Saudi Arabia largely, like, they're either like towards the end of their career or they're not right at the top of their game. I haven't seen a situation like a player who starts regularly for a top six Premier League club going to Saudi Arabia right now.
No.
So I until we are seeing that, like, even if Mbappe goes, which I'm not convinced he will, but if he does, it's a very, very particular specific situation which, as you say, kind of provides a good solution to an awkward problem. I still feel that there is a long way to go for the Saudi Arabian League in terms of, you know, landing that the very top echelon of talent. And I do find it hard to foresee a young player at the top of the game who's playing in the Champions League and the Premier League making that jump right now. I don't preclude it happening in, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, but I don't think we're in that place yet.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. I mean, someone like Ruben Neves is an example of a player who, you know, in his prime years has decided to go. But I think the reason that he decided to go is very obvious, like the huge amount of money on offer. And he's just, you know, he's a guy who played for Wolves. You know, this isn't top, top talent. He's a good player. And obviously we were linked with him a bit, but I just can't understand why he would go there. I mean, maybe money will obliterate all other aspects to this, and he'll just say, well, I'll get all that money, and then next year I'll go to Real Madrid, and it will be one of those weird, quirky things about a player's career that sometimes happen. But I can't really understand why he would do it, apart from the money. But does he need the money? I think he's on something like 72 million euros a year at PSG as it is. I don't know.
I'm just annoyed we can't sell more of our players to Saudi Arabia, to be honest.
I'm just, you know, you can just take off to Saudi Arabia there. I'm just annoyed we can't sell any of our players.
That is true, in general.
Let's get a few of those out. All right.
Should Mbappe decline? I can imagine Edu making a phone call saying like, you like a French-speaking forward, do you? May I introduce a gentleman called Nicolas Pepe?
Have you met my good friend Edouard Nketiah? He could do a job for you. Let's just do one to finish here, because we've got to get going. It's quite late where you are. Helcarax. He's on the Discord anyway. He said, last year I asked you who'd be our second top scorer behind Jesus. Didn't work out that way. Let's hear your top five scorers prediction for the coming season. He says, personally, I feel like Martinelli is going to have a monster year. So he's gone with Martinelli as our top goal scorer. I'm not giving you the rest of his, but let me have your top five goal scorers for the season ahead in order.
in order. I will go. I think I agree with him, actually. I think I'll go Martinelli. Then I'm going to go Saka. Then I'm going to go Jesus. Then I'm going to go Odegaard. And then I'm going to go Havertz.
Right. Well, I've gone with Saka to be our top scorer.
Yeah, I thought long and hard about that. It was an option.
I love that. You thought long and hard about that. No, you didn't. It was about 3 seconds.
Okay, I thought hard.
I've gone Saka first, then Jesus, then Martinelli. I feel like Jesus is going to have a season. I don't know why.
Okay, I like that.
Martinelli third, Odegaard, and then I just put down Trossard.
I forgot he existed briefly, but yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So
I think Saka's a good shout because of the penalties, to be honest with you. And also he's going to play 80 games. So
yeah, he's going to play every minute of every game. Actually, there was a question from Lewis Letty on the Discord as well. He said, do you suspect Arteta will change penalty kick duty for next season? Do you find it interesting that Odegaard was the first to step up during the penalty shootout? And I didn't really find it that interesting because he's the captain and Saka had gone off at that stage. So I don't think we're going to see any change in the penalty taker.
Took a decent penalty though. Odegaard. Jorginho scored a couple in this preseason, hasn't he?
Yeah, skippity hoppity.
I mean, his record's very good. If he's, but will he be on the pitch enough? That's the question.
That is it.
I think he'll want to take the next one,
sure.
Especially after the West Ham miss. I think he'll want to put that right. He's shown that character before. I think he'll want to do it again.
I think so. All right. Well, look, we had better leave it there. We will have a podcast for you on Thursday. Myself and Andrew Allen will talk to you a little bit about what happened in the game against Barcelona, which is taking place Wednesday night. So because there's the 8-hour difference in time, it'll probably be evening time on Thursday for a lot of you guys over in the UK and Ireland when we have that. But we'll have a podcast for you on Thursday. We'll talk about the Barcelona game and all the rest. For now, though, we better leave it there, James. No plans to do Radio City Music Hall or Sydney Opera House between now and the next Arscast Extra?
Maybe next year. Maybe next year.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you, folks. We'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.